Hello, beautiful people. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I am your guest host, Sansara Taylor. On today's show, we'll be sharing segments from the RNL Revolution Nothing Less show, which airs on YouTube. Let's begin.
Welcome to the RNL, the Revolution Nothing Less show. My name is Sansara Taylor, and I am very pleased to be joined by Annie Day. Annie, welcome.
Thanks, Sansara, and welcome to everyone tuning in. This show is about an actual revolution to overthrow this whole system of capitalism imperialism, which is causing horrors for people here and all over the world. We base ourselves on the revolutionary leadership of Bob Avakian, who's brought forward the new communism, a framework for human emancipation to get all the way free.
We are coming to you in incredibly high stakes times. Trump mega fascism is barreling towards consolidation, stepping up its fascist crackdown and rampage in the wake of the very wrong murder of Charlie Kirk. We'll say more about that in a few minutes. The ground invasion of Gaza has begun. This is a horror for humanity.
And we want to point you to two key places to go to look to for ongoing leadership in this very intense situation, which is one. Following the social media from Bob Avakian, he is giving real-time leadership on his social media platform to navigate this complex situation and a deeper body of work that you can find that gets into the whole new communism that that he's re-envisioned in terms of how humanity actually could live. You can find that on his social media platforms at Bob Avakian Official. And on his Substack. And you can find that and ongoing analysis at revcom.us, the voice of the revolutionary forces, and much more. And we'll say a bit more about that later in today's episode.
Yeah. So every Monday, revcom.us does a new edition. Go there definitely every Monday. Incredible articles. We will scroll through on the screen just some of what we've covered this week. And check there throughout the week. And like Annie said, Bob Avakian Official, his social media, these are two critical places to go every day.
So we have a packed show. Let's get into it.
How should decent people respond to Trump's latest fascist crackdown?
With God as my witness, we are going to use every resource we have at the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, and throughout this government to identify, disrupt, dismantle, and destroy these networks and make America safe again for the American people. It will happen, and we will do it in Charlie's name.
Safety? Not for immigrants or black people or the homeless or others that Trump hates. Trump, Vance, Steve Miller, they're not fighting for your safety. They are cynically using the very wrong murder of Charlie Kirk to bum rush a permanent fascist crackdown on any and all opposition while they have people fearful and on the defensive. You see, they don't just want your fear. They need it. Don't give it to them. The Trump fascist regime needs your fear because everything they're doing is illegitimate. Their threats to hunt down and imprison leftists for their speech violates the First Amendment.
A woman just stood up and started screaming.
Free DC! Free Palestine! Trump is the Hitler of our time!
She was a paid agitator, and you have a lot of them. And I've asked Pam to look into that in terms of RICO, bringing RICO cases against it, criminal RICO, because they should be put in jail.
It violates the Fourth Amendment protections from illegal search and seizure. And their calls to turn in neighbors and get them fired for their opinions is a page out of Hitler's playbook. So don't give them your fear. The Trump fascist regime needs your fear because they're lying. The overwhelming majority of political violence is carried out by the radical right. The bombings of abortion clinics, the massacres of Latino people and Jewish people and black people again and again, the military occupation of our cities, the genocide and starvation in Gaza that the U.S. is backing, this is political violence, and it's not from the left. You see, Trump, Vance, and Steve Miller, they don't object to political violence. They're stoking it. So don't give them your fear. The Trump fascist regime needs your fear because as powerful as they are not all powerful. There are more of us who oppose them than support them. Millions more. There are people in every institution and at every level of government who from different perspectives find this fascist program outrageous and abhorrent. So as deadly as they are, and as much as time is running out to stop them, it is not too late. So don't give them your fear, don't give them your silence, and don't give them the future. But how? How to not be afraid when they really are hammering people, weaponizing the full machinery of the state to terrorize, intimidate, and silence? how to win back the future when they hold the levers of state power. There is only one way. All of us, millions and millions of us, converge at the same time in the same place. Washington, D.C., November 5th. Nonviolent, but determined. From many different perspectives, with one unified cry. This nightmare must end. Trump must go now. And we keep coming back, again and again, growing in numbers so strong that we inspire people the world over. So strong that we compel major shifts and realignments among the rulers so that Trump cannot govern this country, cannot impose his fascist program, and cannot even hold on to the reins of power. This is the only way, and there's not a second to waste. So stop what you're doing and make plans to be there. D.C., November 5th. And don't just plan to be there. Dedicate the next 7 weeks of your life to organizing others to be there. Go to refusefascism.org. Download the call for this nonviolent mobilization. Spread it to friends. Spread it to strangers. By the hundreds, by the thousands. Everyone must know. As we do this, we use every attack to further expose Trump's illegitimacy and bring more people to our side. We defend everyone who is wrongly targeted, whether or not we agree with all their views. We pour into the streets this October 18th, making No King's Day 2 even more massive than the first. And most of all, November 5th. Washington, D.C., we make this the biggest nonviolent but determined mass mobilization in U.S. history. We do not stop until Trump is removed from power. There is no other way. Time is running out. The stakes are enormous, and there is not a second to waste. So let's get to work because we still have a chance to stop this nightmare and rescue the future. D.C., November 5th. I will see you there. Look, I love Jimmy Kimmel, but he did say something completely wrong.
He needs to make a decision. You want to be a dictator or just a dick? Because you can't...
No, Jimmy, Trump is a dictator and a dick. But you knew that. And now, the suspension of the Jimmy Kimmel show is a major escalation in the total fascist crackdown on society. Coming after the firing of Stephen Colbert, the message is clear. No matter how prominent you are, watch what you say. If you're brown, you better carry your papers. If you're black, you're a DEI hire. You're fired. If you're a woman, get back in your place. And if you're trans, you should just disappear. We see concentration camps springing up, military in our streets, and all this is just the beginning. If Donald Trump is not driven from power, there is no living with this fascism, and it will only get worse. This is why refusefascism.org was out immediately yesterday in front of Kimmel's studio protesting his suspension. This is why everybody, every voice of conscience, every prominent voice, every celebrity, every comedian, every lawyer, every public figure needs to speak out today. There can be no more capitulation to mafia fascist threats. We can do this the easy way or the hard way. F*** you. Jimmy Kimmel needs to be back on air, and every single one of us from across this country needs to converge in the biggest mass nonviolent but determined mobilization in U.S. history, November 5th, the anniversary of Trump's election, Washington, D.C., many different perspectives, raising a single unified cry. This nightmare must end. Trump must go now. Trump must be driven from power through the nonviolent, determined action of the tens of millions of us, the majority in this country who does not want to live in a fascist America. But there is no escaping it. There is no waiting it out. It will not get better. It will only get worse. We need to rise to the challenge of history. The whole world is watching what we do. November 5th, be there. Bring everybody you know.
What good is love and peace on earth when it's exclusive? Where's the truth in the written word? If no one reads it, a new day dawning comes without.
Troubled times. Sansara, that was a very good, sharp, exactly pitch perfect video. And it's the kind of thing that we need to be doing and will be doing a lot more of. That will be on our channel as a standalone social media. It was first posted by you. The RevComs are going to repost it. But it enables us to do all this kind of real-time response and political, ideological battling that we have to do to actually repolarize people to change their thinking in this urgent moment.
So we want to take a minute, though, and talk a bit more about November 5th. This is a call for mass mobilization, nonviolent, but as I said in the video, determined, and on an unprecedented level, numbers that we've never seen before in U.S. history, a truly historic outpouring, bringing about and fighting for the fall of the Trump fascist regime. This is a mobilization that was initiated by refusefascism.org, and it is open to all. And it needs to be taken up by everybody, every decent person, every organization, everybody from different perspectives, different walks of life, everybody who doesn't want to see a fascist America. And there are tens and tens of millions of us. There are more of us than there are of them. But it is really urgent that we get this in their hands, that we spread this, and that we organize others to become part of this. We're coming at this as communist revolutionaries, people who want a whole different system, a whole different way to live. But we need to be standing shoulder to shoulder with people who are coming at this because they want their country back. They want to restore what they believe this country should be about and could be about. But Trump is trampling that. And they're right about Trump trampling it, even if we're going to have an argument about what this country really is about in its essence. And that's what we need. We need to be shoulder to shoulder in this fight. And so there's an urgency to getting this everywhere right now. I want to talk about some of the ways we want to do this, but you wanted to
share
something.
I want to say something more about the stakes that you're talking about. And actually, I want to bring in Bob Avakian's voice on this in one of his recent social media messages in Revolution number 133. Listen.
If this fascist regime is allowed to remain in power, everything that decent people have felt they could rely on to seek justice will be brutally shut down. Every uplifting moral value will be reviled and repressed. Every sphere of society will be remade in terrible ways, in line with the male supremacist, anti-LGBT, white supremacist, and anti-immigrant cruelty, and the anti-scientific, health and climate-destroying madness of the Trump fascist regime, and the bloodthirsty ravings and depraved violence of fanatics heading the Department of War, with the deranged maniac Trump having his finger on the nuclear button. Every vision and every active striving for a better, more just world, for a future worth living in, will be violently suppressed and effectively foreclosed, at least for the foreseeable future. This is not hyperbole. It is the bitter reality that is being rapidly enforced. But here is another profound reality. The massive mobilization called for by Refuse Fascism and Open to All represents the real possibility, the only real possibility, of actually driving out this fascist regime and putting an end to the endless horror it is determined to perpetrate.
I think people should really live with that and think about those stakes and walk through in your own mind, in your own thinking, why he says this is not hyperbole, why he's laying it out as sharply as he is about the actual fact that any fight for a better world will be foreclosed if we don't defeat this fascism. Any space that we have that we urgently need to resist and work to stop this genocide that's happening in Gaza will be foreclosed if we don't defeat this fascism. Any aspirations you have for how people should live, for how people should treat each other with kindness or compassion, that will be foreclosed if we don't defeat this fascism.
Bob Avakian has more scientific clarity on the stakes negatively, but also the possibility, the real world possibility of defeating this fascism. And it's so important that in the face of what we're facing, there's no room for despair, for demoralization, for defeatism, for fatalism, for giving them your fear. Now is a time for people to really fight for the reality that we do outnumber the fascists. We have right on our side, and we have the material basis to defeat them, to drive them from power, both through the force of the people standing up, yes, nonviolently, but with massive determination and a huge tidal wave, a political earthquake, as he called it, from below, but also in the fact that there are deep divides within the ruling structures of this country, in every institution, in every corner of society, divides where right now the fascists are on the rampage, and the people who are opposed to it are being cowed, are being purged, are being fired, are being picked off one by one. But many of them are speaking out in different ways. If there was a political earthquake from below, that could be realigned in a different way. And we really could bring about the conditions where Trump is removed from power. And so this profound reality, it is so important when BA speaks about what we're facing, and people have to be sober about this, the negative stakes, but also what is possible and what we have the responsibility to fight for. No one else is providing this kind of clear-eyed, big-hearted, and scientifically confident strategic nerve leadership that Bob Avakian is providing. And so we have to take that up as well.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly why people should follow him. Follow Bob Avakian Official on social media, on Substack. I want to ask you about Refuse Fascism and the need and the basis to unite very, very broadly. What is it that people can do to be part of this?
So recently, Refuse Fascism, the collective leadership, which I'm part of, together with others, Andy Z and others, put out three things for organizers. And everybody can become an organizer starting right now with refusefascism.org or with other organizations taking up November 5th. But it highlighted three things. We highlighted three things people need to do. First is to really appreciate the power of what is concentrated in the call that Refuse Fascism has initiated for the fall of the Trump fascist regime. This is the one-page flyer that makes the case. Fascism is not a looming threat. It's upon us now. And it breaks down the stakes of negatively what this regime is doing and why and how it must be stopped. It concentrates the stakes of defeating this fascism and what it will take, how it can be done. This call needs to get into the hands of millions and millions of people. So one of the number one things you can do on your own or with friends is go to refusefascism.org, print it out, and hand it out. Hand it out by the hundreds, hand it out by the thousands across this country. Everybody needs to see this. There are so many people agonizing who are looking for leadership, looking for direction, don't know what to do. They need to get this in their hands. This November 5th outpouring is not even known on the scale that it needs to be known. And that needs to change from the grassroots up, starting today, starting tonight, starting with you, starting with everybody getting organized. So that's number one. Number two is to reach out to other organizations, other organized movements, other people of influence. This needs to be taken up. It was, yes, initiated by Refuse Fascism, but it is not their thing. It is not our thing. It is objectively what anybody who wants a decent future needs to see succeed, which means you need to throw in with it. So we have to take this to other organizations. We have to invite them into the November 5th coalition and movement, including meetings, which I'll talk about in just a minute. And one important expression of this is to fight for the No King's Day 2, the second one, which is being scheduled for October 18th, to be as massive and powerful as possible everywhere across this country. It will matter. And to bring November 5th into that. So there's a real momentum. All out for No King's Day, October 18th, and onward to D.C. on November 5th for the fall of the Trump fascist regime. And the third thing is Refuse Fascism is hosting November 5th mass organizing meetings all over the country, everywhere that they have chapters, and everybody who, where there's not a chapter, can organize this as well. There are four major mass organizing meetings for November 5th, which have been scheduled now. One on Saturday in Los Angeles, this upcoming Wednesday in San Francisco, and then the following weekend, the 27th and 28th in Washington, D.C. and up in New York. We will put the details on the screen. I will be speaking at those four mass organizing meetings. There will be speakers from other organizations, other perspectives, standing together, mobilizing for November 5th. And we need hundreds and hundreds of people at these meetings getting organized. So to take this out and spread it and bring others to it. So those are three concrete things. And then, you know, we can't let it go without saying you actually have to make your plans to get there yourself. That's critical. It's important. Get your plane ticket, make your reservations, make your housing plans, get together with others, start solving those problems because we all have to be there.
And I also just want to say, Sansara, you were telling me that you'll be available if you're not in one of those four cities and want to host a mass organizing meeting, then people should contact Refuse Fascism and ask if you can Zoom in.
Or another leader of Refuse Fascism, Coco Das or Andy Z or Paul Street or another one of the leaders to Zoom in and be part of your mass organizing meeting. Yeah.
So we want to go now to a social media video from Rafael Cadaris, who's one of the leaders of the RevCom Corps for the Emancipation of Humanity. Look, one of the lines of attack against Refuse Fascism is there's communists working with it, so don't work with it. And those are based on, that attack is based on lies, it's based on slander, and it's based on a really wrong understanding of what we're even facing and the need to unite all can be united, opposing all these divide and conquer schemes in whatever guise they come in. So Rafael does a really good job of taking this on all those levels. And we're going to go from there into a segment from the interview that Sansara did with Bob Avakian in January 2025. And here he speaks really deeply to what is new in the new communism. Let's watch.
Mao killed more than Hitler. Let's talk about ignorant and stupid anti-communism, which is way too common, not just from fascists.
America is never going to be communist.
Those crazy communists?
But also from liberals and leftists. And by the way, I use the term ignorant and stupid anti-communism because ignorant just means you don't know. Stupid means you don't know how to think. Case in point, recently, an anti-Trump activist told us he didn't want to work with Refuse Fascism because the RevComs, revolutionary communists, are involved in it, and Mao killed more than Hitler. There is so much wrong with this statement. A, Mao didn't kill more than Hitler. B, we RevComs base ourselves on the new communism developed by Bob Avakian, which is very different and much better than what came before. And C, none of this is a good reason not to join together to fight the Trump fascism we're all facing now. But let's get into this Mao killed more than Hitler thing. First of all, you do know how many people Hitler killed, right? In addition to the 6 million Jews, the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union led to the deaths of about 25 million people there. Plus about 5 million Germans were killed in battle. Plus millions more from the US, UK, France, Italy, China, Yugoslavia, Poland died fighting against the Nazis. So if you add that up, it's about 40 million people. So what's your source for the claim that Mao killed more than 40 million people? Or is it just something that you heard and you're uncritically repeating it? A few years ago, I was at an elite college and a student actually told me that Mao killed 500 million people. I was like, you do know that there were only about 500 million people in China when Mao came to power, right? People just make shit up.
Mao killed 10 million people in China. I'll see your 10 million and raise you 10 million more. Mao killed 20 million people. I'll see your 20 million and double it. Mao killed 40 million people.
So when and how exactly did Mao kill so many people? Was it during the Cultural Revolution that you've heard so many bad things about? No, there was no mass murder during the Cultural Revolution. There was mass democracy, millions of people coming into the public square, criticizing leaders, overturning old ideas and ways of doing things. And yes, there was some violence during the upheaval, but this was opposed by Mao. In fact, the whole point of the Cultural Revolution was to prevent capitalism from being restored and continue the revolution by mobilizing the conscious activism of the people, discussing and debating which way forward, and not to carry out the kind of purges and executions that Stalin had done. Or maybe you think Mao killed more than Hitler because of the famine that happened between 1959 and 1961 during the Great Leap Forward. But what's your source on this? Did you Google it? Did you see it on Wikipedia? And by the way, crowdsourcing information, especially in a capitalist system that brainwashes people with capitalist ideology and promotes capitalist ideas, is not a good way to tell what's actually true. But if you do go to Wikipedia, you'll see that there's a pretty wide range of statistics on famine deaths, from 2.6 million to 55 million, which might give you a clue that there's something fishy going on here. Yes, there was a terrible famine in China during this time period, and many people did die, but no one actually knows how many people because there wasn't reliable census info at the time. And in fact, many of the death toll statistics that these scholars are coming up with are based on calculating lost births as deaths. In other words, fewer babies were born during these famine years because, It was a famine. And yet these get counted as deaths. But let's put aside the specific body count for a sec and ask, did Mao kill all these people? Like how Hitler killed the Jews and slaughtered people throughout Eastern Europe? No. Not even close. There were three main causes of the famine. One, China suffered some of the worst drought and flooding of the century, which devastated agriculture and food supply. This was the main cause. The food just wasn't there. Two, the Soviet Union actually split with China during this time period, taking away resources and burdening China with debt that had to be paid. Three, there were real political mistakes and economic mismanagement by the Communist Party. But when Mao found out about the hunger crisis, he made major political and economic adjustments to try to deal with it. So no, this was not a man-made famine, like what Israel and the US are doing right now in Gaza, where the food is literally sitting right outside the gates and being prevented from coming in by the political leaders. Exactly the opposite. Did you know any of this? Have you looked into it? Or are you just regurgitating the bullshit you've been told about communism? Now, let's talk about how many lives Mao saved. Do you have any idea what China was like before the revolution, ruled by a handful of rich landowners, warlords, and foreign capitalists? The 25,000 people who died on the streets of Shanghai every year? The parents who had to sell their children just to survive? Did you know that life expectancy in 1949 when Mao came to power was 32 years? And it doubled to 65 years when Mao died in 1976? Did you know that by the 1970s, Maoist China had the most egalitarian healthcare system in the world, reaching into the rural areas with barefoot doctors and eliminating diseases that had plagued China for centuries? Did you know that the Nobel Prize-winning economist Amartya Sen calculated that if capitalist India had the same healthcare system as China under Mao, about 4 million people per year would have been saved, which adds up to about 100 million people over those years? Did you know that Mao and the Chinese communists kicked out the colonial powers who had carved up and plundered China, massively redistributed land, and ended the horrific patriarchal practice of foot binding, as well as prostitution and opium addiction? By the way, not by criminalizing prostitutes and drug addicts, but by giving people meaningful lives and creating a society where workers, peasants, and women were not objects to be exploited, but were taking center stage in building a new society. Let's talk about the ethos in Maoist China of serve the people, and how radically different that is, and so much better than the me culture of this capitalist society. Now, to be clear, there were serious problems in the Chinese Revolution as well as the Russian Revolution that did lead to bad things, some of them very bad. But that's just the point. This was humanity's first baby steps beyond capitalism. And now, thanks to decades of work that Babavakian has done, there's a new communism, which builds on the accomplishments of these past revolutions, which we don't get told about, but also breaks with and discards a lot of wrong thinking, wrong methods, and wrong practices that undermine these revolutions. For example, and this wasn't the cause of the famine in China, but one contributing factor was that local Communist Party officials were exaggerating how much food was being produced in order to prove their loyalty to socialism. Because under Mao, communism was the official ideology. And it wasn't like you were killed for disagreeing with that, but there definitely was a lot of pressure to get in line with that. And that definitely undercut the kind of critical thinking and fearless truth-telling that are so essential to a vibrant society. So what Babavakian is putting forward with the new communism is that we need a very different atmosphere in the new socialist system, where people can surface problems and disagreements, where dissent and intellectual ferment and critical thinking are fostered. At the same time, and as part of the process of radically transforming the economy, politics, and culture to uproot and abolish all forms of oppression and exploitation. And that's the point. We do need a revolution, and there's a much better way we could be living. I mean, even if you take the most ridiculously inflated numbers about the death toll of communism, it pales in comparison to the death toll of capitalism in its normal workings, killing millions and millions every year from war, starvation, and preventable disease. Not to mention the spirit-crushing suffocation of just living in a system that doesn't give a damn about you. So if you can't stand the world the way it is, the white supremacy and misogyny, the terror against immigrants, the destruction of the environment, the anti-scientific lunacy, the iron fist of capitalist dictatorship smashing everything true and decent right now. The new communism is for you, because it's the only way to actually address the things you care about. So instead of mindlessly mouthing this system's anti-communist brainwash, look into Babavakian and this new communism for yourself with an open mind, and let's discuss and debate it while we stand together side by side in the fight to defeat this fascism that now threatens all of us.
I want to come back to the part of ways in which you've gone further, since you helped me with the further or farther, ways that you've gone further than communism as it was understood and as it has been carried out before the new communism.
obviously, that's a big, very big subject, you know, and I've written about this, for example, in a work of mine, Breakthroughs, which you can get at revcom.us. And it talks about the initial historic breakthrough made by Marx, which I've referred to, and then the further breakthrough with the new communism. In the initial conception of communism and in the social societies that were brought into being on the basis of attempting to apply communism, first in the Soviet Union, beginning in after the revolution in 1917, up until the mid-50s, when capitalism was restored there. And then in China, with the success of the revolution in 1949, until, as I said, after Mao's death in 1976, capitalism was restored there. And you can see from the fact that I'm talking about the revolution being made and capitalism being restored, that this is a tremendous process of struggle against the old world and all the old ways, which are always, you know, working and being and poised to spring back and come back into power and reverse all the emancipating gains that the revolution has achieved. It would take a long time, and I have written extensively, to go into all of this. But, you know, the basic thing is, in the, you know, development of the communist movement up through the Chinese Revolution, there were certain concepts like, you know, the idea of reification, for example, of the working class or the proletariat. The idea that by its mere position in society as the exploited class, and this was applied more broadly to exploited and oppressed people in society, by mere virtue of their position and the conditions to which they were subjected, those people who were part of that class more or less spontaneously came to, had the right idea about where things ought to go. And you see a lot of that now, you know, in a lot of the postmodernist thinking, you know, has picked up some of these ideas of, you know, like, you know, now it's not so much the proletariat, it's different identities, you know, and each identity knows because of its own lived reality, you know, it knows what the answer to its situation is, you know, and there was a lot of that in the communist movement, this kind of reification, as it's called, where the idea was that the proletariat sort of spontaneously would come to an understanding of you know, where its interests lie and why it need to make revolution and how it needs to make revolution and so on. There was some of that in Marx and Engels. You know, Lenin struggled against some of that in leading the Russian Revolution, but there was still some of that that went through the history of the communist movement up through the Chinese Revolution. And that's wrong. What also went along with that, was a notion of, you know, that was, you know, somewhat propagated of the inevitability of the victory of the communist revolution. You know, some even said we're condemned to, you know, to achieve communism. Well, unfortunately, no. You know, there is no great mover in history. You know, one of the things, communists are atheists because they're scientific and they understand there are no supernatural beings and forces. But some of a little bit of the same idea crept into the communist movement in the sense that there's some sort of history with a capital H that's moving everything toward communism, you know, basically inevitably. And that's not true. It's a matter of struggle. And the outcome of that struggle is not determined. It, you know, it's whatever, you know, people who become conscious of the need for this revolution and lead masses of people, is whatever they are able to achieve, versus what of those who are posing and seeking to drown in blood their attempts to make that revolution are able to impose. So, you know, there was, that also needed to be broken with that notion. And it also went along with it, including in the Chinese Revolution. I mean, look, there's a lot of slander against the Cultural Revolution in China, for example. Now, not only did it create great revolutionary culture in which the masses of people making revolution came onto the stage, really for the first time in history, but, it, you know, it also gave rise to tremendous, you know, what can be legitimately called mass democracy, with hundreds of newspapers being produced by masses of people in struggle, people doing, you know, putting what were called big character posters, you know, basically political documents up on walls, you know, like the way people pass out, you know, leaflets and posters and things, you know, and now go online, you know, and, you know, put forward their views and carry out struggle. There was a tremendous amount of that which is, you know, ignored, you know, or distorted and slandered. But there was a certain limitation, even though there's a tremendous amount of political ferment through the Chinese Revolution and especially in the Cultural Revolution, there was a certain limitation that this, you know, had to be sort of confined within a framework where the assumption was built in that, you know, that communism was right and that the, you know, the, you, while you could criticize certain leaders for deviating from communism, you, to be honest, if you were to criticize Mao, for example, then you could get in a lot of trouble. So, you know, there was a tremendous mass upheaval and, you know, mass ferment politically and struggle. But there were also limitations and there were also some excesses. Now, those are greatly exaggerated, the excesses, and they did not characterize this tremendous mass political uprising of literally hundreds of millions of people. But there were these limitations within this, which also related to the idea that, for example, if someone came from an upper class background, they were suspect. You know, even though, you know, Mao himself said, you know, I'm an intellectual, I came from a more privileged background, you know, but he became a communist revolutionary. But still, there was this idea that if you came from a more privileged background, you were sort of automatically suspect. And we can see some of the same thing, you know, in the culture now, even though it's not in the name of communism. You know, if you were more privileged, well, then, you know, your ideas are suspect. You know, rather than look, whether people's ideas are correct or not is a matter of whether or not they are true, which means whether or not they correspond to reality as it actually is. And yes, as it's moving and changing, but as it actually is. And wherever anybody comes from and whoever they are, their ideas have to be evaluated on the basis of whether they actually correspond to reality or not. And that was one of the limitations in the Cultural Revolution, as great as it was in many ways, was the idea that there's such a thing as class truth. Mm. There's truth that serves the proletariat, and then there's truth, you know, then there are ideas that go against the proletariat, and that's the truth of the bourgeoisie and the capitalist exploiters, and that's no good. And it's tricky because, you know, people who want to enforce exploitation can cite certain things that are true or certain limitations and use those to attack the whole thing. But you still have to thrash all that out and sort all that out on the basis of what's true or not. For example, I read something by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was a major advisor under Carter, you know, who just died, and, you know, played a very bad role as a, you know, functionary of U.S. imperialism. But he wrote about the Russian Revolution that there was a certain, you know, trend toward, you know, autocracy in the in Russian society, toward, you know, toward tyranny, if you will, and that this, you know, seeped into the Russian Revolution and explained why it was repressive. And I just said, oh, this is bullshit. You know, the whole Russian Revolution was going up against everything about the old society and all the tyranny of the old ruling classes, the czars and the capitalist exploiters in Russia. And then I thought about it a little more and I said, well, there were problems in the Russian Revolution. There were ways in which it became repressive in some ways and suffocated the necessary intellectual and cultural ferment that needed to happen and the ideological struggle over what's true and not and what's a way forward and not. There were, you know, serious, significant problems in that way. So then I wrote and said, well, you know, he has a point. So what's the larger lesson there? I know I'm going on, but I'm trying to give some scope to this so that people can get a sense of the importance of it. You know, I said, well, what's the bigger lesson here? The bigger lesson is even though Zbigniew Brzezinski was a thorough reactionary and a functionary of the most oppressive system in the history of the world, the most, you know, monstrous system in the history of the world, namely U.S. capitalist imperialism, he had a point here. And you couldn't rule out or suppress the point that he had because it came from a bad source. And this is something that's very important to understand. Truth does not depend on who says it. And it doesn't depend on whether you like who says something or not, or whether the overall they're playing a very bad role. What, you know, truth, you know, in, it has to be examined in the concrete and has to be determined on the basis of whether something actually corresponds to reality. And I've made the statement, which is new about the new communism, that everything that is actually true is good for the revolution, is good for the proletariat, you know, whose fundamental interest of abolishing exploitation and oppression is what this revolution is about. It's good for us as communists to know the truth, even if those truths make us uncomfortable, unhappy, make us cringe, as I said, in the short run, in the immediate, because only by really, you know, coming to understand reality in the fullest and most scientific way can you actually transform it in the interests of the masses of people and in the interests of moving beyond all this oppression and exploitation. So even if big oppressors say something, it has to be evaluated on whether it's true or not, and not whether, well, they're a bunch of reactionaries, so what they say is going to be bad, even if it might be true. You know, so that this is also a very important part about the new communism.
Okay, so whatever your stereotype is of a stodgy old communist, that is not what you just saw in Babavakian. This is an incredible, living, far-sighted revolutionary leader who has re-envisioned revolution and communism. The lies that Rafael Caderas was refuting about even communism before Babavakian need to be refuted, but Babavakian has taken this to a whole different place. For humanity, breakthroughs that actually change what's possible for humanity to get free of all forms of oppression, all forms of exploitation, all forms of being divided into masters and slaves, and doing it with just a whole different scope of it changes every sphere of society starting now, and every sphere of human endeavor starting now, and all the way through the process of making revolution and the new society. And you got a taste of some of how that's re-envisioned in that exchange and that answer from him. But you also get a taste of who this leader is and how he goes through the world. It is so counter to the bullshit, the stereotypes and the lies.
The bullshit, the stereotype and the lies about communists in general and all of the really ugly attacks that get directed at Babavakian specifically. And so it's really important that people hear from Babavakian directly and then also are part of spreading his voice and what he's about up against all that bullshit. You know, look, what the questions that Babavakian has put himself to and putting himself to are what most people haven't even thought of. And I do really recommend that segment is from this two-part interview that you can watch on our channel Sansara, you did with Babavakian in January of this year. Watch the whole thing. So look, one of the things that you've been getting on this show over the years is every week an opportunity to engage BA more deeply in the ways that we just watched, a segment of this most recent interview, of the interview that this show did in 2022 with Babavakian, which is a three-part interview. His speeches and Q&As going back years from 2003, older speeches from 2012. There's just a tremendous body of work from Babavakian on film that we've been playing in this show, and you've had the opportunity to get into and get inside of week in, week out. So that's not going to be coming to you in the same form. But here's what we want to let you know is every week on Babavakian's social media platform, there will be being posted a longer form segment. And that will also be featured on revcom.us. And, you know, look, you know, Babavakian's providing this real-time leadership through his social media. That matters. When something gets posted, get inside of it right away. Spread it. Talk about it with others. Talk about the content of it and talk about the method that's underlying that. At the same time, those social media messages are a product of decades of work, a whole body of work that Babavakian has been developing and leadership he's been providing. So even as we're in this, and especially as we're in this really intense, high-stakes situation, people need to be stepping back to understand more deeply, well, what is the system that's given rise to this fascism? How does capitalism even operate? Why is it possible to get to a whole different and far better world? What would that world be like? What kind of method, you know, what we just heard Babavakian getting into, what kind of method do we have to be taking up to see the basis for that world and to be able to navigate to actually break all oppression's chains? So
that's, you know, to stay tuned to Bob Bavakian Official, stay tuned to RevCom.us, and stay tuned to this channel where we'll be reposting those longer form segments.
Yeah, and so all of this, we're sharing this again because we are not going to be producing the weekly show in the way we have for the last few years. So these are the ways you're going to be able to access through Bob Bavakian's platforms, his own social media, and through RevCom.us, a lot of what we have tried to provide here on this show. There's also the website. I guess you spoke on that. I don't know if you want to say anything more about it.
RevCom.us. I mean, it's also, I'll just say this, and we'll say more about the website in its own right at the end of the show, but Bob Bavakian's whole body of work is accessible on this website. You search terms, go to the Bob Bavakian featured works page, and you can get his work speaking to sports and big questions, dictatorship, democracy. What's the nature of capitalism, imperialism? What does imperialism even mean anyway? I was just talking with somebody who asked me, well, okay, what are rights? What happens under communism? What are, you know, with rights? Well, actually, Bob Bavakian has spoken to this really deeply in a series of Q&As he did in 2006 that are available on RevCom.us. So go to that website, get into his deeper body of work. And look, we are going to be, like I said, in this high-stakes situation, out all day, but also up all night. And the deeper we can get into understanding the world, the more urgently we can see the basis for transforming it.
So every week we'll be featuring a selection there, as well as of BA's larger body of work, as well as his most recent social media messages. So with that, we have one other thing. We actually had filmed this interview for last week's show. We did not put out the show last week as we had planned because events just, you know, collided and needed to be responded to in real time. So we saved it. This is an interview that I did with the immigrant rights attorney, Alfonso Morales. I introduce him in the segment. So let's just go to that now. Alfonso Morales is an immigrant rights attorney. He's a member of the Linwood Unified School Board, and he is a leader in the Los Angeles chapter of RefuseFascism.org. Alfonso, we are so glad to have you back on the Revolution Nothing Less show. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here and have the opportunity to inform, at least from my perspective and doing immigration for 20 years, how the current events are affecting us.
Beautiful. What I want to do is talk about one of the most chilling and jarring dimensions of Trump fascism so far. One of the things that has most shocked people's conscience has been the indiscriminate ICE raids, the rolling up on and kidnapping of Latino, Spanish-speaking, brown-skinned people indiscriminately. That began over the summer. And in July, a federal judge put a block on some of the scope of these ICE raids, saying that these raids were violating people's Fourth and Fifth Amendments. They were carrying out in racial profiling, which is a violation of people's of the Constitution, violating people's right to not be illegally searched and seized. Yesterday, the Supreme Court evacuated that stay. I wonder if you could help us understand what this means, what the implications are, and how you're reacting to that.
Well, it was definitely a big blow to our movement. And I'll tell you why. Just the week before, I had had two motions granted to suppress evidence in cases that I had acquired from people that worked at a car wash. And part of my arguments were exactly that, right? That they were discriminated, that they were basically singled out because they are Latino-looking men who speak Spanish, working in a labor industry. And then the Supreme Court goes and co-signs on Trump's work yesterday. And everyone I've talked to cannot believe that basically the Supreme Court has sanctioned discrimination, which gets to the level of persecution when these people are put in what effectively are concentration camps. And why do I call them concentration camps? Because I talk to my clients and they are battling and sometimes have problems getting water, you know, adequately being fed. They're witnessing people attempting suicides and you know, being involved in that as they try and save someone's life. I mean, they're really living in horrific conditions. And I think that people need to not shy away from this, continue to film what's going on and post it on social media. I will never forget what I heard recently about you know, back when the Holocaust occurred, the people in Poland said, well, we didn't know. And you can't say that now because you know. It's posted everywhere. People can see what's going on, the way they hunt people down like dogs in the streets just because of the way they look.
You know, I want to read something that Sonia Sotomayor said in dissent from yesterday's Supreme Court ruling. She said, we should not have to live in a country where the government can seize anyone who looks Latino, speaks Spanish, and appears to work a low-wage job. Rather than stand idly by while our constitutional freedoms are lost, I dissent. And I think you should help everybody understand very concretely what this means. Brett Kavanaugh openly argued that in a city with such a high undocumented population, race and accent and location, jobs should be legitimate parts of deciding probable cause of criminal activity. Is that, am I understanding this correctly?
And that's the part that we're mind boggled, right? In the United States of America, the Supreme Court is sanctioning the arrest of people based on the way they look. And this is one of the grounds of persecution that we have on asylum applications. Like, you have to understand, asylum applications and asylum relief is very difficult. There's only five bases that you can file for asylum. If you're seeking protection from either persecution you've already suffered or a well-founded fear of future persecution that's going to occur that's based on your race, your religion, your nationality, your participation in a particular social group, or because of your political opinion. And that's it. So what are they saying is if your race is Latino or Hispanic and you're dark skinned, and then if you speak Spanish, which is a social group, then we can go ahead and stop you and maybe even take you and question you and figure it out. And you have to realize, and I'm not saying that it's not important that it happens to immigrants, but what I'm saying is the scope of this goes beyond immigrants. It talks about you're including people that just look illegal. Like, what does that mean?
Do you think this kind of shadow docket ruling sanctioning racial profiling is legitimate?
No, of course not. Look, the fact that we are now seen as race as a factor that can be considered, what it is creating, it is multiple violations of our Constitution all within one. So basically, there's a violation of due process now, because if you're a Latino looking person, it's okay to stop you from doing your daily work or business and to basically make you feel like you're being interrogated or arrested when you're just going to the store. If you're a Latino, it's okay for them to seize you and violate your Fourth Amendment rights of unlawful seizures because they're inquiring about whether or not you're here legally. I don't understand how they make this argument that it's okay without even saying that it is outweighed by something. Like, I thought they were going to say that the public safety was a bigger issue or the security of the country, but it didn't even go that far. They just said that it's okay to consider race and the language someone speaks and, you know, the work that they do to consider all those factors in arresting or detaining someone. And that should be unconstitutional. And everyone thought it was.
This gets to the very bold call that's been put out by Refuse Fascism for millions of people to flood Washington, D.C. in the biggest nonviolent mass outpouring in the history of this country. Not a one-day protest, but again and again coming back until the people are a check on this power and actually drive this regime from power. Do you want to speak about the importance of this and how you see it?
Well, it's important that we get into action. And it's what I've been saying, and this is why I show up with the work that we do with Refuse Fascism. It's because no one else is coming. Like, we are it. We are the American people. And you have to understand, like, the principles that this country stands for, the principles of freedom and equity and liberty and justice for all, this is what's being attacked. It's not un-American to say that the person in power right now is not doing what's in the best interest of the country. I think it's un-American to say nothing. And what it's going to take people showing up in mass numbers, like they're starting to do in D.C., for example, where there's been an occupation, and we need to start to mobilize ourselves. And what you need to do is, I think exactly what you're saying, I think this is the effort that we're trying to do. We're going to go straight to the White House. because that's where it's at. And that's what he was trying to do. He was trying to secure the Capitol and insulate himself from protests and so be it, and then go out. And we can't let him take over the White House. It needs to be what it always has been, which is an office, a home for a couple of years, and then you move out. Not when they start to remodel it like some kind of Victorian house and, you know, he's not leaving. Like, that's what the signals that I'm getting. Like, this guy's not, he doesn't think he's going to leave in a couple of years.
Well, I'll say for the, you know, for the RevComs and the Revolution Nothing Less show, there's a lot that actually is truly American about Trump and this, in this open, unbridled white supremacy. But where we come together in the fight that Refused Fascism is waging is that as long as we are forced to live under this system, we are going to fight to defend the rights and the lives of the people that are supposed to be guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution. We're going to fight and stand up and defend them, even as ultimately we are coming from a place of wanting to get beyond this system and its constitution. But right now, there's an existential fight facing all of us, which is why we all need to come together from diverse perspectives to stand up today, going forward, and then converging in D.C. on November 5th to demand Trump must go now.
And you're 100% right. There's always been fragmented sections of people who have their own cause or their own interests. Like, you know, that's the biggest force they get behind. However, again, like you said, we have to come down to our core principles, the things that make this country great, or that, you know, really are the cornerstones of this country. And from there, we can build whatever we want and we can talk about it, we can negotiate, but we're not going to ram stuff down people's throats and become leaders like we have right now at the White House. And if you don't know what we're talking about, open your eyes, because it's all over social media and it shouldn't be happening. The people are suffering. There are people that have been detained for over 3 months already, who have never been in jail before, who are away from their families, away from everything they've ever known. And they've been in this country for 30, 40 years because we keep making it more and more difficult for people to come here or to stay here.
Before we close, I just wonder if there's anything else on a visceral human level that you want to share about what some of your clients are going through, what the conditions are, what people who are not directly affected need to understand more deeply.
There's no mechanism in place for people to come here, not even work related, not even with work visas. It's very an exclusive thing to be able to come here. So the people that have been coming here these last couple of decades have really gone through hell. They don't get on a plane in Guadalajara or Guatemala City and they land in LAX. They have suffered. They've died on the way here. They've been raped. They've been beaten. They've been gone in prison. They've gone through so many horrific things. Then to finally get here and to be treated the way we've been treating them. Because you have to remember, when COVID was here, the farm workers were out there working and they were feeding our country. And it's something they consistently do. And what do we do now? We send buses with soldiers to load them up and lock them up. Because it's almost not even the great deportation, is the great detention that we have going on. And if you're not empathetic to that, I don't know what to tell you, but hopefully we all have a God or someone we think is a higher power. And I always say the day will come when you are asked, when this happened, what did you do? And what you can do right now is show up November 5th in DC and be united against this tyranny.
Well, thank you so much, Alfonso. Really, thank you for your time. It's really important, the work you're doing. We're glad to have you back here on the show.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity. Take care.